This is Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast, episode number 161. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. This is an episode with Dr. Colin A. Ross titled, What is Mind Control? And is being released on Tuesday, April 9, 2013. My interview with Colin was recorded on Thursday, April 4, 2013. Dr. Ross is an internationally renowned clinician, researcher, author, and lecturer in the field of trauma-related disorders. He is the founder and president of the Colin A. Ross Institute for Psychological Trauma. Dr. Ross is the executive medical director of three trauma programs located at Timberlawn Mental Health Systems in Dallas, Texas, Forest View Hospital in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and Del Amo Hospital in Torrance, California. Dr. Ross provides treatment for patients with trauma-related disorders and symptoms. This would include treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, dissociative disorders, borderline personality disorder, addictive disorders, anxiety disorders, depression, and obsessive-compulsive disorder. The symptoms treated and the admission criteria are suicidal ideation, homicidal ideation, self-destructive and addictive behaviors, and inability to function. Dr. Ross has written extensively on the subject of dissociation and trauma. His latest books include Trauma Model Therapy, A Treatment Approach for Trauma, Dissociation and Complex Comorbidity. Other books by Dr. Ross include The Trauma Model, A Solution to the Problem of Comorbidity in Psychiatry, and Schizophrenia, Innovations in Diagnosis and Treatment. Dr. Ross's books are available through his website, rossinstitute.com, which is rossinst.com, and at amazon.com and at area bookstores. And of course, Dr. Ross has also written many books and papers on MKUltra and government mind control, including the CIA's doctors and many other books. And he's authored 170 professional papers and 27 books total. He has reviewed for numerous professional journals and is a member of the American Psychiatric Association and is a past president of the International Society of the Study of Trauma and Dissociation. And in addition, Dr. Ross has served as an expert witness in over 50 court cases, consulted on television, movie, and video productions on trauma-related disorders, and produced 6 educational videos and CDs for mental health professionals on the treatment of trauma-based disorders. You can reach Timberlawn Trauma Program at 1-800-426-4944, Forest View Trauma Program at 1-800-949-8439, and Del Amo Hospital at 800-533-5266. And again, I mentioned the Gnostic Media bookmarks that have the fallacies on the back, and that those go out with each book order, and we also sell those individually for those interested, or actually in a group of 3 or a dozen. We also have the first 4 years of the Gnostic Media podcast up on the website, and this week's episode is dedicated to Sanjit, Randy, Matthew, Sherwin, and Oscar. And of course, we do our best to provide just about everything here for free that we can, so your donations and website purchases are greatly appreciated. This show is run on donations and our website sales. This is not corporate media, but independent media in the truest sense of the words. And of course, by donating or ordering one of the books, a DVD, the She Who Remembers audio archives, a t-shirt, or getting a membership to download the older podcasts, you help to continue this unprogramming. And of course, we greatly appreciate your support. The views expressed by the authors and guests of this unprogram are their own and are not necessarily those held by myself, the host, or Gnostic Media. You can check out the website at www.gnosticmedia.com. That's GNOSTICmedia.com. You can contact me through the contact form on the website or directly at contact@gnosticmedia.com. Thanks for listening and thank you for your support. And here's my interview with Dr. Colin Ross, Part 1, What is Mind Control? And by the way, we did record Part 2 just today, and that will be out next week. Enjoy the interview with Colin.
Well, thanks for having me on, by the way.
Yeah, Dr. Colin Ross, thank you for coming on the Gnostic Media Podcast. We're extremely excited to have you on. I've been interested in your research for a while. Obviously, you and I have a lot of overlap in our interests, both of us studying MKUltra and the like. So why don't you start off by telling us, who is Dr. Colin Ross?
Starting with the hard questions, huh?
Indeed.
So I am Colin Ross, born in Canada, went to medical school in Edmonton from 1977 to 1981, and then I did my psychiatry training in Winnipeg from 1981 to 1985. From 85 to 91, I was a sort of academic medical school teaching psychiatrist in Winnipeg. And then in 1991, late 91, I moved to Dallas. Originally was at Charter Hospital of Dallas, and that whole corporation doesn't exist anymore. I'm now at a hospital called Timberlawn, where I have a trauma program that we basically work with people who've had horrendous, abusive, neglectful, chaotic, violent childhoods, and they have all kinds of mental health problems as a result. And I also consult to a program in Michigan and a program in L.A., same type of program. So that's kind of my quick CV.
How did you get involved in studying MKUltra and mind control and all of this?
Well, basically, I was completely unaware of it up until moving to Texas at late 91. It was not discussed, mentioned. There's no, like, conspiracy of silence inside psychiatry. There's just silence. Like, you didn't even have to get together and decide to cover it up because it just didn't exist, sort of thing, in terms of, you know, just your average Canadian psychiatrist. So, and wasn't really particularly interested in, you know, spies or the CIA or the history of intelligence or anything like that. So I was really completely out of the loop. So I get down to Texas, and within a couple of months, people are starting to tell me, I'd heard many, many stories of abuse by dad, abuse by uncle, violence inside the family. But patients with multiple personalities started to tell me, well, when I was a kid, I was taken to a military base or I was taken to some kind of hospital, and experiments were done on me that involved lab equipment, EEG equipment, physical spinning, memorization exercises, hypnosis, drugs, and deliberate creation of alter personalities. So I thought, well, that's pretty fantastic. But then I said, oh, I'm going to look into this. So I read, there's like 3 or 4 or 5 books published over the preceding 15 years. I read those, started to look in the professional literature a little bit, didn't find much of anything, and then ended up going down to Washington. I was at a conference in Northern Virginia, and I set up to go to a CIA reading room, which just involves, you know, looking up the CIA online and finding out their address and corresponding with them. And so I'm at the conference hotel. This is kind of just a silly side story in a way. So I'm at the conference hotel, and I go, there's a line of taxis there. I hop in the front taxi. I'm going to this address in Northern Virginia. He says, okay. And then he starts talking. It turns out his story is he was an Afghani police officer, and then he came over to the United States, and now he's working as a taxi driver. And he says on the way, how would you like to go through the Pentagon property? Sure. So we go through the Pentagon. We drive by there, and helicopter lands. And I'm thinking, well, that's a little suspicious, but then we just carry on. And we pull up on this nondescript street to the address, which has no signage or anything. And he says, well, what kind of a building is that? So I don't know. It's just some kind of office building. So I leave him, wondering what that was all about. Walk into the room, and this kind of entryway, there's all kinds of military people, and there's a sign saying CIA and DIA secure phone. So I walk up to the desk and say, hi, I'm here, and I have some paper. I show the guy to read some documents under the Freedom of Information Act, which was going to be all the MKUltra documents. And of course, he looks at me like, oh, yeah, Freedom of Information Act, who's this guy? And there's a tough phone call upstairs. Finally, the woman from the CIA comes down. She's extremely pleasant, cordial. Well, come on. Nice to see you, Dr. Ross. We hop in the elevator. So there's me, the CIA woman, and all these guys in uniforms. I just kind of look casual. We go up. I think it was the seventh floor or something. Anyway, we got off, and we walk down the hallway, and there's a big door, kind of looks like a submarine door or something, with a big Justice Department seal, keypad. So we go through that door, and then I get signed into secure space. So I'm now in secure space, and I have to sign something, show my ID. Then we go through another door into the reading room. And the woman leaves that room, goes back into the hallway, goes upstairs, come back with a cart with 149 MK Ultra files on it and a whole bunch of perfectly sharpened pencils with a rubber band around them and a pad of notepaper. And there's a woman literally about 85 years old sitting in the room with me to keep an eye on me. And so this CIA woman leaves, and I basically leaf through these 149 files and make notes and decide which ones I want. And in the end, I just got all of them. And so back then, it's 15,000 pages at 10 cents a page. So now it's like $35 for the CD-ROM. So in the middle of the day, the woman who's like guarding me says, well, what are those documents that you're reading? Are they classified? And I said, no, they were all declassified back in the 70s. So she says, well, what do they need me here for then? I go, I don't know. And then at lunchtime comes, and the CIA woman hasn't come back to say hello for a while. So the 85-year-old woman says, well, I need to go for lunch now, but I can't leave you alone. So out in the hallway, there's two black guys who are working on some remodeling down the hallway. So she says to them, well, I'm going to go for lunch. Could you keep an eye on this guy? And they kind of go, sure. So I got signed into secure space, went into a secure reading room, and the door of the reading room opened back up into the hallway that leads to the elevator to go back down to the street. So I kind of thought to myself, I think I might be dealing with the federal government here. So it's kind of this, you know, the spookiness of dealing with the CIA combined with, what are all these procedures? And somebody upstairs is, you know, check, Dr. Ross was signed into secure space. Check, Dr. Ross was kept under observation the entire time. Check, no documents were missing. So that was my entry into this whole world.
What is your family background? Is there anything there that ties into this?
Not really the only. I mean, my dad and my uncle were in World War II, and my dad was in the infantry, but he didn't have any intelligence functions. And my uncle was a pilot who was actually my grandmother. The military came to her house three times to tell her that her son was missing and presumed dead. He's a pilot in the Sahara, went down and walked out from fighter crashes in the Sahara three times. But I was never aware of any of those guys, my dad or my uncle, having any, you know, intelligence functions. And I wasn't aware that anybody was doing anything remotely intelligence related. They weren't. My dad was just worked for an oil company. He wasn't a military contractor or anything like that. So basically, I had nothing to do with the whole subject.
What is mind control?
Well, mind control's kind of a vague thing and kind of a specific thing. And it sounds, in a way, like it's more than it is, but it also sounds kind of less than it is. I want to explain that. So the idea that you can totally control somebody so they're a total automaton robot and they make no independent choices at all, that's the idea of mind control. And there's programs that strive for that. And the technical definition of mind control is, it's exactly what it says. Various efforts to control the mind, control behavior. There's some synonyms for it in the professional literature. So sometimes mind control is called coercive persuasion. Sometimes it's called thought reform. So there's a couple of different terms. And coercive interrogation. So when an enhanced interrogation now. So now we hear about enhanced interrogations at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay. That those are all really forms of mind control. And the techniques that we know from public domain documents that are used at Abu Ghraib and Gitmo all go back through a series of manuals in the 70s and 80s back to MK Ultra and the original CIA mind control programs. So at the lowest, most simple level, mind control is when a teenage guy tries to get a girl to have sex with him, uses mind control, usually not very successfully. The next level is, you know, when Pepsi tries to take the Coca-Cola market by controlling our choices through advertising. And so it just goes up from sort of very general efforts to influence other people, their choices and their behavior, through to more structured, studied kind of program. And so I kind of divide mind control into two levels in terms of, you know, actual warfare-related mind control. I think there's one level that I call religious political mind control, which would be where you get recruited in the Middle East somewhere, you go to, you know, a certain training camp location, there's tons of indoctrination, praying, religious exercises, and you end up thinking that 70 virgins in heaven sounds pretty good, and you go blow yourself up. So there may not be a psychiatrist involved in that. There may or there may not. But it's more general kind of religious indoctrination and programming. But it certainly fits the definition of mind control. Then the kind of mind control I mostly focus on is where there's actually a doctor, a psychologist, or a psychiatrist involved, and there's a one-to-one relationship between the person who's being controlled and the doctor. And then there's drugs, hypnosis, a whole variety of different techniques used. But the goal is exactly what it says, control of behavior.
Somebody last year told me, and he's actually in the field of psychedelic research, that because we don't know all of the neurons and all of the chemicals and how the brain works, that therefore there is no mind control.
Well, so that all comes back to, what do you mean by mind control? Are all these companies spending millions and millions and millions of dollars without any research to demonstrate a return on their investment? You know, do politicians go and shake hands and spend hundreds of millions of dollars on their campaigns because that's all a waste of money and it has no effect on people's voting patterns? So it's clear that people are molded, shaped by their culture, by their environment. We have different hairstyles, different fashions, different tastes in music than we did 40 years ago. So you can't really say people are unaffected by their environment. That's absurd.
Well, and then so, when you find out, you know, for instance, Edward Bernays's influence and the CIA's influence on the Laurel Canyon music industry and all of this stuff, then it adds a whole nother layer to control through the music, etc. Are you familiar with Dave McGowan's work?
A little bit from what you've told me. I'm not really a scholar of that. Okay. But there's, that's kind of, if we go from just Pepsi and Coca-Cola trying to grab market share from each other, and then pharmaceutical industry, car industry, whoever we're talking about, then the next level up would be CIA or other government agencies collaborating with, working with, influencing, paying the media to insert certain information and block out other information, which could be done through what news gets covered, what doesn't, what the spin on the news is, what the feature film is, who's the hero in the feature film, who's the bad guy. So there's all these levels, but that doesn't mean, you know, everybody all of a sudden in lockstep is turning left and then turning right.
Sure.
But it's
exactly.
But it's definitely a huge industry of influence. But the part I'm interested in the most is basically my just to give you my political kind of viewpoint on this. I'm not, just as a matter of principle, in any way against the CIA, against the government. I'm not an anarchist. My personal belief is, growing up in Canada, if it wasn't for the U.S. military and intelligence apparatus, there's no way that Canada would have prevented the Soviet Union from coming over the pole. I probably would have died in Gulag a long time ago. But that also doesn't mean...
Sorry to interrupt you real quick, but there's a whole history there that... that proves that the United States had actually funded and propped up the Soviet Union from the get-go. So actually there would have never been that Hegelian dialectic between the U.S. and Soviet Union if we never propped them up in the first place.
Right, and that goes back then to the Second World War and the Nazis, same story. But all I'm saying is, I'm not just like rabidly against the military or the CIA or the government, you know, as a political stance. And so my main focus is, ethics of psychiatry, since I'm a psychiatrist. And I'm strongly, strongly, strongly of the opinion that there's been massive, systematic abuses of human rights up to the level of people dying by major leaders in psychiatry, the major medical schools, the profession as a whole, not in some sort of casual way, not a few rogue guys in a basement, for basically the last 60 years at least. I mean, it's not that I'm like an apologist for the government or I think the government should be able to get away with anything. That's just not my focus.
How many types of mind control are there that you're aware of?
That depends, again, how you kind of carve up the pie. The way I would look at it is there's kind of just a program of mind control, but it's not that there's different types of mind control. There's different methods and techniques for the purpose of mind control. So that's kind of splitting hairs. But basically, the main techniques that are involved are, if you're in the Middle East, you can't just walk up to somebody and say, hey, how would you like to blow yourself up tomorrow? And by the way, you'll get 70 virgins in heaven. I mean, you got to get some sort of control, influence, and work on them and prepare them in some fashion. So in the psychiatric level of mind control, we're talking about you got to get control of a person's life space to start with. So they're either going to be in the military already, they're somebody that you've got a lot of dirt on, or you've got a lot of dirt on their father, or you've bribed them, or you've just grabbed them in some fashion. So they can't be just out in the world living their free lives and telling all their friends about what you've been doing to them. So control of the life space, and then control of the information the person gets and the information they don't get. And so this could mean being in a prison somewhere, could be on a remote military base, could be in a hospital, but somewhere kind of secure. And then the actual techniques then include sensory deprivation, sensory isolation, food deprivation, all the things that we hear about in terms of interrogation, bright lights during the night, bright noises, different kinds of drugs, puddings, mock killings, electric shock, threats of death. Then you can bring in a whole variety of different drugs, which could be by mouth, IV, in your food, in your drink. And then there's deliberate exercises to split off a part of your personality and shape it and create a Manchurian candidate, which is a multiple personality, where you've got this new identity created inside, and you insert hypnotic access codes, which in the CIA documents, these are described in great detail. And the CIA documents from Bluebird and Artichoke in the 50s say it can be either hand signals, tones over the phone, or virtually anything that's hypnotically conditioned. And so one of the lead guys who did this kind of work was named G.H. Estabrooks, who's a psychologist at Colgate University in upstate New York. And he, in 1943, published a book called Hypnotism, and as late as 1971, wrote an article in Science Digest describing this Manchurian candidate work in great detail. And so the typical scenario is there's all this conditioning that goes on, and then he's got a person who's got Jones A and Jones B, is what he says. Jones A is the regular Marine guy. Jones B is the conditioned personality. So Jones A is called into Colonel so-and-so's office and said, he's told, well, I'm sending you on this courier assignment to Tokyo. Here's some materials to take and hand over to Colonel so-and-so on the far end. Then the colonel says, the moon is clear, which is the hypnotic signal. Out comes Jones B, who's the Manchurian candidate personality created by Estabrooks. The colonel in Washington gives him some classified information. He says, okay, go back inside now. Jones A, totally unaware of all this, flies over to Tokyo. Colonel on the far end says, oh yeah, thanks for the documents. Did you have a nice trip? The moon is clear. Out comes Jones B, gives that guy the classified information. Response is inserted. Back home he goes. And the mission can be a courier mission, infiltration, assassination, anything. And this guy, G.H. Estabrooks, my research assistant, went to his archives at Colgate. I have a large amount of documents from that. including correspondence back and forth between him and J. Edgar Hoover, spanning multiple decades. Very high-ranking people in the FBI coming out to Colgate to meet with him, talk with him. Him doing workshops on military bases, including Fort Bullibird, on the military uses of hypnosis and creation of the super spy. Him having military officers and medical officers come to Colgate for symposia, and him speaking with, publishing with, corresponding with documented MKUltra mind control contractors, including Louis Jolyon West and Martin Orne. So, I mean, this is a definite for real story, not just a rumor. And so it's not just that there's this technique or that technique. It's a whole collection of different techniques.
It's across the board. They're using dozens of techniques right. against us.
Right.
Were there any documents when you went to the CIA that were released to you that were not released previously in other MKUltra document releases?
No, all I got was the stuff that was released in the 70s, which includes MKUltra. MKUltra is the best known, but it's actually, in fact, one of the milder mind control projects. Project Often is much more sinister. There's very little information on it. There's Artichoke, Bluebird, MK Naomi, MK Delta, QK Hilltop. There's a whole series of them that are declassified. And on most of them, there's just a very small amount of paper that you can get. And nothing has been declassified since 1975-ish. And I filed requests for numerous different people, different topics, including Project Monarch, Project Sleeping Beauty, and have been basically given zero. So the Iron Curtain comes down in 1973, and everything's classified after that, not counting Stargate, which was a psychic spying program.
Well, I was just about to ask you here in a minute, what was Project Stargate? Do you want to go into that for a moment?
Sure. I don't remember the exact date, but I remember Robert Gates was the head of the CIA at the time, and he was on Nightline with Ted Koppel, and a guy who was the liaison between the CIA and the military on Project Stargate. And so Robert Gates said, yeah, this existed. It was called Stargate. We spent $20 million. So there's no question that this program existed. And there's several books about it now. And it was the Stanford Research Institute in Palo Alto was involved. A lot of the work was at Fort Meade. And basically these guys, this is just the part of the story that's declassified. These guys who would be selected for psychic abilities or intuitive abilities. The training wasn't that intensive. Basically, it was relatively mild. And they would go into a room, which was kind of a quiet, dim room. They'd lie down, and they would do what's often called astral projection. So they'd either be given, in the current lingo, in the military lingo, it's called remote viewing. But basically, you send your mind out of your body and go around the world and observe.
Do you believe they were really doing this?
Oh, they definitely were really doing it. There's no question that they were attempting it. And so the way the exercise would happen, besides practice exercises, is they would go in, they would lie down at the beginning of the day, and they'd either be given longitude, latitude coordinates, and they would try and project their mind to that coordinate, see what was going on there.
So you're talking like Men Who Stare at Goats type of stuff.
Yeah, that's what Men Who Stare at Goats is all from, that program. Except the references to the Jedi weren't actually part of it. So, and then the other thing they would do is they'd say, a plane went down in Central America, can you try and find it, sort of thing. And so on Nightline, Robert Gates is playing the role of the skeptic. We spent money, but we spent money on a lot of stuff to see if anything shows up, and I don't really believe in it. But the guy who was the liaison between the CIA and the military, because a lot of the actual work was done at Fort Meade, he said, no, we got operationally useful hits that were confirmed by other intelligence. So that's not my opinion. That's the opinion of a guy who, Robert Gates, at the time he's the director of the CIA, says, yes, this guy was the liaison between the CIA and the military on Stargate. That guy's opinion is they got operationally useful information from it.
You know, Dr. Andrea Puharich was invited by Gordon Wasson on one of the trips down to Mexico, and they were supposed to do remote viewing tests. And then, of course, Wasson later attacks Puharich in the official record. But do you know anything about Puharich's involvement in this type of research?
All these people, so I was, I had an illustrious career as a high school dropout until I went to college at the age of 25 in 1975.
I know the feeling exactly.
So actually I learned a ton about English literature, history, philosophy, anthropology, and a lot about life, and lived up in the Canadian Arctic. I'm very glad that I did that. And then I went back to college, got into medical school in 1977. But I read Wasson, Puharich, Lucy Genstoff, Zen Buddhism, Alan Watts, all this New Age stuff that was going on there, not having the faintest idea that there was any connection to the CIA. And then over the years, and also from things you told me, just more and more the quilt kind of gets stitched together. This guy wasn't just a random guy. So Wasson was actually contractor on MKUltra subproject 58 through J.P. Morgan, who was his employer.
Really? So Wasson, you actually have the exact project number that Wasson was working on.
Yeah, actually I can just look it up here. And the reason I have that is because I have the document. So he's listed in there as, you can have several clearance statuses. Some of the contractors were top secret. So when you look in the documents, it says cleared at top secret. Some it's all white out, you don't know what their status is. And some it says unwitting, which means they didn't realize it was CIA money because it was funneled through some front organization. So in the documents it says unwitting, National Philosophical Society and J.P. Morgan and Company were the contractors, 1956, $2,080, an expedition to collect hallucinogenic mushrooms. And it in the actual documents, which are just a thin pile, it says they went to Mexico to collect these mushrooms. And then, so I read Wasson's book, Soma, The Divine Mushroom of Immortality, which is about the Amanita mushroom, which is that red toadstool with the sure. white flakes that are in all the fairy tales and so on. And his thesis is about the use of that by shamans going back for thousands of years.
Sure.
That was his academic area of study. And he went to Mexico. So there's like more than one thing going on at the same time. He has an academic interest in the subject of hallucinogenic mushrooms.
What do you think of his letters? And I know you saw this recently. I sent it to you, Wasson's letter just 11 days before the Life magazine article popularizing magic mushrooms comes out. He and DCI Alan Dulles are having communications with each other. And I've also got another letter between Wasson and the former ambassador to the Soviet Union, George Kennan, where Wasson is actually trying to recruit Kennan to the CIA, and Kennan tells him that he doesn't want to work for the CIA directly, but if the DCI or president want him to do a job, basically that they can contact him directly and have him do it.
Well, that's just the way things work. So when you're looking through these MKUltra documents, if it says cleared at top secret, well, then, you know, he's cleared at top secret. They're not going to say that's the case if it's not. The thing is, when they say that the person is unwitting, mm-hmm. you don't know if that's actually true or not true. But another example is Ewan Cameron, who is a MKUltra contractor at the Allen Memorial Institute, which is part of McGill University, which is in Montreal. And when you look in the documents, it says that he was unwitting, but he was president of, at different times, the Quebec Psychiatric Association, Canadian Psychiatric Association, Society for Biological Psychiatry, and the World Psychiatric Association, which he co-founded with William Sargent, who was the lead British psychiatrist on mind control, and two other people. And also, Ewan Cameron was on the team, headed by Leo Alexander, that went over and interrogated the Nazi doctors at Nuremberg. So it's a guy who's that politically connected, who's over there interviewing Nazi doctors, who's founding the World Psychiatric Association with the leading mind control expert in England. It's just absurd. He can't possibly be unwitting just based on that information alone.
Sure, and so, sorry to interrupt you there. When you go through the documents on Gordon Wasson, you see that he's working, you know, and I went to Princeton through the Mudd Library and pulled a lot of documents from the CFR archives there that show that Wasson was actually a chairman for the Council on Foreign Relations, and he's working with guys like Walter Lippmann. I pulled a document out of the U.S. Library of Congress that shows that Wasson was working with Edward Bernays, the father of propaganda, for at least a decade. And when you see all of the things tie in together and the social engineering that Bernays was doing and what Wasson was doing, I think that they tie perfectly in together. And then, you know, at the Hoover Institute up at Stanford, I found a letter from Wasson to Bertram Wolfe where he says, essentially, that the you know, he's asking Bertram Wolfe if he remembers the last letter to him, and he says, where I was asking you where Tolstoy had said that the printing press was a mighty engine for disseminating ignorance, and then he turns and says, and this Mazatec affair is a case in point, you know, and this is just a week after he's published this big sob story in the New York Times, where he's supposedly expressing all of this remorse in the newspaper about what he's done, even though he casts half the blame on Maria Sabina, who he set up by going through the mayor's office in the first place. And, you know, when he went to Maria Sabina's home, they thought it was official business, and that's the only reason why she talked to him at all, because the mayor showed up at her door and asked her to talk to Wasson. And so, you know, of course, Wasson casts half this blame on her, but, you know, here Wasson, he creates the psychopaths and hippies, et cetera, that he complains about that descended on Huerta de Jimenez. But he turns around and complains about them when he's the very guy who created them by launching this entire psychedelic movement with the help of guys like Aldous Huxley. And interestingly, right, you know, Gordon Wasson, you know, I have numerous letters where Gordon Wasson, you know, between Wasson and, for instance, DCI Dulles or Wasson and numerous other guys, where he's attempting to recruit them or they are being recruited or brought in as members to the Century Club. The Century Club is, you know, it's basically an art association on the East Coast. It's actually, and I did a lot of research into it. It's basically a CIA front. Last week I was watching this movie on the Lincoln assassination, and interestingly, right in the middle of the plot is the Century Club. But so DCI Alan Dulles and Gordon Wasson appear to have been two head key figures there, and they bring in guys like Ellsworth Bunker, the ambassador to Vietnam, and you know, all of these other figures like George Keenan, Frank Astill, who was a member of the CFR and a big banker. His son Arthur Astill was one of the guys who worked with Goldman Sachs up until 2002. You know, so there's all of these banking tie-ins there between, you know, between Wasson and these other guys and the CFR and everything. And anyway, I just forgot my train of thought there and where I was going with that. But
that's the reason for that, I think, is because there isn't one train of thought. It's this intricate, vast web of connections, relationships, partnerships, right, front organizations, disinformation, information, and actually running both sides of a controversy. So within the same sort of operational plan, there's, you know, we're going to have people representing the left and people representing the right, and we're going to stir all that up for some other purpose altogether.
Sure, so absolutely. All of that's that typical is just, dialectic stuff.
Right, so that's just operating procedure 101, sort of. And that's what I discovered is when you, just in, you know, the sector of this that I looked into, which is kind of centered on psychiatry. So you can't do a computer search for things published in the 50s and 60s. You actually have to physically go to the medical school library, go to, say, the Journal of Nervous and Mental Disease, 1950, pull it down, volume 1, volume 2, and look through for articles on LSD or articles on whatever, and also for authors that you've already identified. Then you find a paper. Then you see who the co-authors are on that. Then you keep an eye out for that co-author. Then you find a paper by him. And then you see at the bottom of his paper, it says funded by the U.S. Either Office of Naval Research, U.S. Air Force Office of Scientific right. Research, Department of the Army, or it's funded by Human Ecology Foundation. And then going around the trail, another side of the network, find out that Human Ecology Foundation, for a totally documented fact, is a front organization MKUltra money was given to them, and then they would fund the projects, which is how somebody could be unwitting. They would naturally know it was coming from the CIA. One of the cutest things is there's another fund called the Geschichter Fund.
Right.
Geschichter was a doctor.
That's the one that James Moore supposedly funded Wasson for the trip to Mexico.
Right. So it's, again, this is in the documents and in the Senate testimony in the 70s. Because the project was funded through the Geschichter Foundation, and the Geschichter Foundation was a private philanthropic foundation, that triggered matching funds from another sector of the federal government. So the CIA only had to fund half of it, and the rest of the federal government unknowingly funded the other half.
Well, get this. I was doing some research up at through the Hoover Institute archives, and there's a lot of information there that shows that Wasson was running a number of funds for the CIA directly. You know, so he's running the Russian Student Fund and the Free Russia Fund and all of these things, and he was also running a program to popularize the Russian Orthodox Church for Russian immigrants that they were bringing in who were getting slaughtered by the Bolshevik and Stalinist, goings on there, the 40 million people that were killed there. And so they're doing all of this, stuff on the side, this Russian Student Fund. Did I just remind you of something when I mentioned the Student Fund, et cetera?
Yeah, I'm looking up the MKUltra project on Hungarian refugees to see if I can find
it. Yeah, you know, and what's interesting is, you mentioned, and we'll go into that here in a little bit, but you talk about Lee Harvey Oswald and Dr. Jolyon West and Jack Ruby and these guys. Well, guess what? Lee Harvey Oswald was close friends with George de Morenshield, who ran one of these funds with Gordon Wasson.
Yeah, that's the way it just goes endlessly. This person's connected to that person, connected to that person.
Right. You know, so I've been trying to get Judith Baker, who was Lee Harvey Oswald's girlfriend, to talk to me about if she had ever seen George de Morenshield and Gordon Wasson together in the same room, and she won't give me a straight answer.
I like just another example. There's millions of little examples of this. So, early 1950s, there's Fort Detrick, which was the U.S. chemical weapons headquarters, and there was a project MK Naomi. Through both MK Naomi and MK Ultra, the CIA funded work at Edward Arsenal, Fort Detrick, and this Frank Olson guy was a CIA employee, but he's either CIA or military or both.
Sure, yeah.
And he was head of a lot of chemical weapons development. And then the cover story is that he developed a psychotic disturbed mental state after being slipped LSD by Sidney Gottlieb, the head of MKUltra, at a retreat, and the LSD was in Cointreau liqueur. This is what the admitted to CIA version of the facts is. And then he went off the deep end, and they took him to a doctor who was also an MKUltra contractor, of course, and then he jumped out of the hotel window and died. So Hank Alberelli has written a book about all of this and conclusively documented that it was actually a murder. He was getting ready to be a whistleblower. The whole LSD thing is a cover story. But one of the leading characters in Alberelli's book, which was very thick and extremely well documented,
I've read it cover to cover,
is this guy Pierre Lafitte,
right,
who looks like he pushed Frank Olson out the window. He was actually on site. And he's a well-documented sort of hitman, contractor, shady guy, involved in all kinds of things for years. And he has got a whole list of pseudonyms. So I forget the first name of his pseudonym, but one of his pseudonyms, his last name was Hidell, H-I-D-E-L-L. And he worked at the Riley Coffee Company in New Orleans in the early 60s, the same coffee company that Lee Harvey Oswald worked at, whose pseudonym was Alex Hidell. So try and tell me that's just a coincidence.
Oh, yeah. You know, and
Is
of
this
course,
just.
they want us to all think it's all coincidence and whatnot.
But it's impossible. It's just, if you buy that, that's coincidence.
You know, speaking
I've got
of.
some swamp water I want to sell you.
Exactly. Speaking of Hank Alberelli, last month, well, you know, I had been tracking his work because, you know, he was a lawyer for the Carter administration, and he
Right.
also worked at the Treasury Department. And he had promised to help me file a whole bunch of FOIA requests and things, and I was taking notes and keeping record of all of his emails and everything. And he pretty much led me on a wild goose chase for about 3 years. And so eventually I had, you know, he had stated that he was going to file these FOIA requests with me and show me how to do it all. He wouldn't give me anything on the specifics of what he was doing when he was filing the information. Then, you know, he claimed that after 16 months that the CIA had never responded to the FOIA. He had also sent me a fake response from the CIA claiming that the CIA had filled or had not filled the FOIA, that there were no responsive documents there. And then he goes on to later claim that he never actually filed the FOIA request. But so through all of this stuff to just check up on him. And he was constantly saying that, you know, there was no reason to question Gordon Wasson and all of this stuff, and constantly trying to lead me away from researching Wasson's background. So finally, I filed a FOIA request on Wasson directly with the CIA, which was very promptly filled, which is where I got the documents between DCI Dulles and Wasson together, showing that there was a direct connection there. So, you know, Hank Alberelli for 3 years led me on a wild goose chase. And I think what he's been doing is exposing. You know, smaller aspects of the operation while trying to keep the concurrent operations under wraps. Because I think once you get that Gordon Wasson was CIA and part of MK Ultra, you know, the whole other layers of MK Ultra start to come unraveled. And I think this was key. But you know, looking, you know, Hank Alberelli's background, he's right there at the Carter White House when all of this stuff is unraveling, and he's a lawyer there. He may have been one of the lawyers on the MK Ultra team trying to keep this stuff under wraps.
Right. So that's why Mulder's motto is trust no
Well, there you
one.
go. So yeah, you know, and of course, I called him out on all of this stuff publicly, and he lied and name called and denied and did everything but answer the specific questions. And I just pulled up all of his emails every time he lied and said, "This is what you said on this date. This is what you said on this date." And he couldn't answer. And you know, for a lawyer, for a trained lawyer at the White House, he could not stick to one single fact. He just resorted to every sophist, name calling, fallacious attack you could imagine.
That could be a result of training.
Well, I think, yeah. Well, I think that's what the whole idea was. But I think the whole goal was to, you know, in his book, he very clearly says there's no reason to doubt Wasson, which, how do you know there's no reason to doubt Wasson? You know, and Wasson was one of these key guys. He's the vice president of propaganda for JP Morgan Bank. He was trained by Edward Bernays.
Right.
You know, so the, you know, the more that I've looked into Wasson's background, and I've got 1,000 pages of his personal letters between intelligence officials, between ambassadors, between the head of the CIA, and I even pulled letters which you read out of Yale from the Professor Charles McLean Andrews archives at Yale, showing that Wasson had intentionally covered up the Hall Carbine affair in the Civil War, which I think
Right.
is what earned him the promotion to Vice President of Propaganda for JP Morgan Bank.
Yeah, you've clearly, as an investigative reporter, based on documents, based on facts, established that Watson was top secret, cleared, heavily involved in MKUltra, LSD, hallucinogens,
Well, don't
and
tell
hope.
that to the rest of the public out there because they still hate me for publishing that.
Yeah, but it's clearly a fact. I mean,
Yeah, I agree with you.
you can't have letters setting up lunch with the director of the CIA
Right.
and not be involved. It's absurd. I mean,
Sure.
that's
And
a
not
that's a
only that, but you know, here's Wasson, you know, in one of the letters, Wasson is clearly trying to recruit George Kennan, the former ambassador to the Soviet Union and Yugoslavia, to the CIA, and Keenan is denying this, like I said, telling Wasson, you know, I don't want to work for the CIA after the OSS fiasco. Just have the president or DCI call me directly if they want me to do anything. And I mean, number one, For Wasson to know that the CIA wants to recruit George Kennan, he would have to be in the know. Number two, that's top secret information for recruiting a Soviet Union ambassador to the CIA. Number three, I mean, you know, people will actually sit there and say, well, this isn't proof that Wasson was on the end. I mean, if you think about it logically, there's no way he wasn't. There's no way that somebody who was just some willful idiot banker would have had the knowledge to be going about recruiting ambassadors to the Soviet Union to the CIA. And not only that, but we have all of these letters, him working at the Century Club, him recruiting Ellsworth Bunker, the ambassador to Vietnam to the Century Club. And like I said, Frank Astrul and, you know, Walter Lippmann and all of these other guys are at the Century Club as well. It's a who's who of CIA, OSS, and mind control guys.
Right. Yeah, I think you've conclusively proven that. It's not a... And people can just say, I don't want to hear it. But you can't
logically... Well, yeah, it's the religious hero, that's why.
So you can't logically or rationally refute it.
Yeah, well, and, you know, there's a whole team of ethnomycologists and things out there that have been trying to attack my work, and I've just been asking them, so show me one point, one citation that's taken out of context and doesn't lead to the conclusions that I'm showing. And not right. one person that's been attacking the work has provided a single example of an error.
Right. Right. Well, nice work.
All right. So what was the Osiris Complex?
Well, that's one of my books. And so the reason it's basically a collection of case histories of people with multiple personality or related kind of dissociative disorders. And the purpose of publishing is, number one, I just like writing and publishing. But... It's all good to talk about theory of, you know, how mental health things work and how the diagnoses work and so on. But you have to have, like, real live cases to really bring it to life and understand it and feel it. So it's kind of the real case example foundation of this trauma model that I have, which is a general model for the relationship between psychological trauma and mental health problems. And the reason it's called the Osiris Complex is because of the Egyptian myth where Isis and Osiris are brothers, and there's a jealous brother of Osiris who cuts him into pieces and throws the pieces all over the place, and his sister Isis comes and gathers all the dismembered pieces up and brings them back to life. So that's kind of a metaphor. Instead of the Oedipus Complex, which is Freud's thing, which is based on the Greek play Oedipus Rex,
right,
and the idea is that everybody wants to kill their dad and sleep with their mom.
Did you happen to read the Deadhead article I sent you this week?
Yeah, I did.
What did you think of that and Bernays using the Oedipus Complex for these goals?
I thought the Grateful Dead fans are not going to want to hear this.
Did you? What do you think of the article so far? Is it too off for you?
No, it's not too off at all. I'd have to reread it. It sounds like not every allegation in there is cited with a reference.
Not yet. Yeah, we're still building it all.
Right. So you can't quite tell. Like when you say this member of the Grateful Dead was a CIA guy. Okay, so obviously I would need to see some documentation. But I already know that you don't just throw things out wildly without either a lot of circumstantial evidence or direct proof.
Right.
So... but I already know that under MKUltra, Louis Jolyon West infiltrated Haight-Ashbury district and was actively involved in that subculture. And I know that Jolly West, who's a top secret cleared MKUltra contractor, who was spliced into the Manchurian Candidate programs, he killed an elephant at Oklahoma City Zoo with a dose of LSD. And I'll give you a couple other facts about him. So he's... well, it's all such a complicated web all the time. So he's on the board of the Cult Awareness Network, which is his expertise. So he starts off as a military psychiatrist. Then he interviews the downed Korean pilots, along with several other guys, including Margaret Singer. And then these guys become experts on CIA military mind control because they're the contractors doing the work, and they're directly involved in the Manchurian Candidate programs. And then they kind of morph into experts on destructive cults that use similar techniques as the communist Chinese used, which is how they found out about them because they interrogated the pilots who made the false confessions of germ warfare. that were maybe not even false confessions anyway. But so they start off as Jolly Western, a small group of guys, as military contractor, military psychiatrist. Then they became CIA mind control contractors. Then they morphed into a public academic career of experts on destructive cults and formed the Cult Awareness Network. And then there's a huge battle between the Cult Awareness Network and the Church of Scientology, because the Cult Awareness Network is calling the Church of Scientology a cult, which the Church of Scientology doesn't like. And so the net outcome of all of that is the foundation is a feud between Jolly West and L. Ron Hubbard, like a personal feud. And L. Ron Hubbard, you know, his story goes back into military intelligence personally. So there's some sort of like backstory personal feud going on there. Then you've got these two organizations. And then the net outcome was that the Church of Scientology sued the Cult Awareness Network so many times that they bankrupted them. And in the court settlement, they got the right to operate the Cult Awareness Network. And so then Jolly West is involved in that whole story. He's killing an elephant with LSD at Oklahoma City Zoo. And there he is at UCLA, chairman of the Department of Psychiatry. And all
there
of a sudden,
the elephant Tesco that he killed, wasn't it?
Right, yeah, Tesco.
Somebody messaged me the other day that they had tried to get a memorial put in for Tesco over Jolly West's actions, but the university refused to do so.
Yeah, they wouldn't want to get into that. It's just like the Rutgers basketball coach. Until there's a video out and everybody sees it, we just don't want to be dealing with that. So, but a couple other little facts about Jolly West, just illustrating how this is all connected together. So when Lee Harvey Oswald is shot by Jack Ruby, might be a good idea to have a psychiatrist come to talk to Jack Ruby, right?
Sure.
So who comes to talk to Jack Ruby? Jolly West. And what is his conclusion? It seems Jack like Jack Ruby shot Lee Harvey Oswald while having a seizure. Which is, I mean, so if you can't figure out, that's a cover story. And so then flash forward a couple of decades, Oklahoma City bombing, and we capture this guy that nobody's ever heard of. He's taken to Tinker Air Force Base, Timothy McVeigh. Who's the psychiatrist who's brought in to interview him?
Jolly West.
Yeah. And what is?
And ironically, you also talk about he was the psychiatrist brought in to talk to Patty Hearst.
Yeah, and then the Patty Hearst is a whole other complicated story that loops back to the Cult Awareness Network, because the leading person in the Cult Awareness Network was the daughter of Leo Ryan, who was killed at the airport in Jonestown.
So what's Jolly West's connection to Lee Harvey Oswald?
The closest I can do on that is a Dr. Birch in Houston, who is part of TRIMS, Texas Research Institute for Mental Sciences. And I've got a lot of documents from there showing all three branches of the military and CIA contracts. And that includes brain electrode implant work. So Jolly West is, I forget now if he published in an edited book, edited by Birch, or he was a co-author of Birch. It was one or the other. And then Birch is a co-author for publishing with Robert Heath in Tulane, who's doing brain electrode implants. Yeah, okay. That's how it starts all tied together.
So, yeah, this is a book with Ron Siegel, Jolly West, and it's got a bunch of these guys in here. Let me just
my loop before I forget my loop.
Okay, so, sorry.
West is academically publishing with Birch, who's publishing with Heath, who's publishing with another doctor whose name I just forget right now, who emigrated from Cuba. And that doctor is a person that Lee Harvey Oswald lived at his house. That's as close as I've got that tied in.
Well, here's who's in this book. It's Roland Fisher, who's the one who Terrence McKenna misquotes regarding the visual acuity and psilocybe mushrooms. We've got Ernest Hartman, Marty Horowitz, Murray Yarvik, Joseph B. Huaz, PhD, I don't know, and then Weston Labar, another interesting one. Theodore
Sorbin. He's an interesting anthropologist. He's tied in through, if you've researched him, you'd end up at anthropology, because he's an anthropologist,
sure,
which would take you to Margaret Mead.
Well, Margaret Mead is dirty as can be, from what I can tell.
Right.
Well, she was there at the Macy conferences with, who was her husband? Her husband was one of the guys
Gregory
behind.
Bateson.
Yeah, and Gregory Bateson, and he's one of the key guys behind MKUltra and Esalen Institute.
They were both OSS contractors during the war. And Gregory Bateson is tied into Talcott Parsons at Harvard and the cybernetics group. And there's documents about that that involve, that are, you can't get access to at Harvard, that involve mind control programs with Russians.
So well, it just endlessly all ties together. Archives. What's that? I'm sorry. I was just saying that Harvard has me blocked out of their archives.
Right.
So there's a couple of others here, though. Wade Savage, Ronald Siegel, and Wallace D. Winters is another one that listed there.
Mm. So I don't know all those names. Some of them I recognize.
Let me just read you this real quick. I think you'll get a kick out of this. You probably read it the other day already. The role of drugs in the exercise of political control is also coming under increasing discussion. Control can be through prohibition or supply. The total or even partial prohibition of drugs gives the government considerable leverage for other types of control. An example would be the selective application of drug laws permitting immediate search or no-knock entry against selected components of the population, such as members of certain minority groups or political organizations. But a government could also supply drugs to help control a population. This method, foreseen by Aldous Huxley in Brave New World, has the governing element employing drugs selectively to manipulate the governed in various ways. To a large extent, the numerous rural and urban communes, which provide a great freedom for private drug use and where hallucinogens are widely used today, are actually subsidized by our society. Their perpetuation is aided by parental or other familial remittances, welfare and unemployment payments, and benign neglect by the police. In fact, it may be more convenient and perhaps more economical to keep the growing numbers of chronic drug users, especially of hallucinogens, fairly isolated and also out of the labor market with its millions of unemployed. To society, the communards with their hallucinogenic drugs are probably less bothersome and less expensive if they are living apart than if they are engaging in alternative modes of expressing their alienation, interesting wording, such as active, organized, vigorous political protest and dissent. The hallucinogens presently compromise a moderate but significant portion of the total drug problem in Western society. The foregoing may provide a certain frame of reference against which not only the social, but also the clinical problems created by these drugs can be considered. Louis Jolyon West.
Well, you can go on and on and on forever. So tied into that, I've got documents where, and the CIA guys are like sending memos back and forth to each other in the early 50s, and they always refer to the Soviet Union as the Soviet, which is the terminology. So the Soviet this, Soviet that.
Well, guess who is one of the U.S. government's leading Soviet spies?
Who?
Gordon Wasson.
Oh, yeah. Surprise, surprise.
See, and in fact, I've got a paper that I got was sent from Columbia University, this toward a Russian policy that Wasson sent to Allen and John Foster Dulles and, you know, all the key guys, C.D. Jackson, the head of U.S. psychological warfare, all these guys got a copy of it. But Wasson, because of his wife and everything and research on mushrooms, I think he was using the mushroom research and, you know, some other stuff there as a, you know, way to get in to be a spy on Russia. But there's something there between the tie of Lee Harvey Oswald and George de Morenshield and this this fund that they're running, that Wasson and de Morenshield are running together, that I think may tie Oswald to Wasson and the whole Russia going back and forth to Russia thing. I'm just speculating there, but it seems right. Like it would be a good possibility for a connection that, you know, Lee Harvey knows George de Morenshield is a good friend of his. Wasson is working with both the Morenshield brothers. And Wasson is a spy for the Soviet Union. Wasson is doing all this work for the Soviet Union. He's running these funds. He's doing the Orthodox Church promotion in the U.S. for the Russians. All of this stuff makes sense that Wasson would have some sort of key element in there with Lee Harvey Oswald. And not only that, but right. Bruce Adamson names Wasson more than 22 times in his series on the JFK assassination. Lists Wasson as a key suspect in the entire plot's organization.
Well, clearly you should, well, I guess you are, in fact, should write a book about Wasson, just focus on Wasson.
Right, this. Yeah.
In 1953 or 4, so going back to the CIA correspondence, internal correspondence about the Soviet, they were concerned that the Soviet was going to grab up the entire world supply of LSD, which was manufactured by Sandoz Pharmaceuticals, hence the Animals British rock group song, A Girl Named Sandoz, in the 1960s. So in order to solve the problem of the threat of the Soviet gathering up the world supply of LSD, they contracted a top secret clearance in 1953-4 with Eli Lilly Company for $400,000 to create a secure domestic supply of LSD. So this is a fact. The actual first manufacturer and distributor of LSD in the United States was Eli Lilly Company. And LSD works on the neurotransmitter serotonin. So the expertise in serotonin physiology that became the foundation of the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor antidepressants like Prozac, which is made by Eli Lilly, all comes from their work on LSD. So there's a direct series of steps from contracting with the CIA to produce LSD to understanding serotonin physiology to developing SSRIs. That's a whole other history that could be filled in.
You know, and interestingly, Prozac is based on fluoride, and fluoride put in the water, and I think is one of the things that is used to dumb people down and make them docile. Do you have anything to say about that?
Well, that's interesting because the chemical name of Prozac is fluoxetine.
Right. Well, and, you know, there's videos on YouTube that you can watch of these guys doing scientific studies back in the 50s on fluoride, and they put a drop of fluoride on a mouse brain or in a petri dish or whatever. I forget what it is. It's been a couple of years since I saw it. But and then they film this under a microscope, and you can just watch all of the nerve endings and everything that they put it on just immediately dry up and die. And they're pumping this stuff into people like mad, you know. And it's clearly, you know, and not only that, but fluoride is one of the only substances on Earth that can make water catch fire.
I'm well aware of the concerns about fluoride. I haven't researched it enough to really have a solid opinion on it. But I'm aware of chemtrails, and I wouldn't be the least bit surprised if there's a connection between chemtrails and multiple sclerosis, for instance. I don't know that for a fact.
Interesting.
But well, none of these kind of things would surprise me.
Well, the show that I just put out yesterday, a friend of mine, Clint Richardson, he's been investigating the history of chemtrails and geoengineering, and so he realized that the government has to give full public notice and the public has to consent to the spraying for anything that they do. So he started going through the newspaper public notices for his county and found right there weather modification, spraying, etc., public hearing to be held, you know, da-da-da-da-da. Nobody shows up at the public hearing. They slam down the gavel and they say, okay, you can go spray. So here we have, you know, public notices in the newspaper in every county in the country this went out to. And they admitted publicly, and people don't read the damn newspaper, they don't read the public notice section, right. So it went completely under the radar. And I was thinking if the government always requires the public's consent, I wonder if at some point, if you went back through the newspapers, if you could find where the government had published in the public record, in the public notices in the newspaper, that they were planning on doing LSD experiments on the public. And so then, therefore, they would have legal consent from the public, because if the public didn't respond and show up to these hearings, if nobody responded, then that's giving the government full consent to do this stuff.
I can imagine some lawyers coming up with some counter arguments on that point, but that's how
the government has always informed the public. This is like why when you register a business, you're supposed to go publish in the newspaper your DBA that you're doing business as, so because that gives the public notice, right? So, you know, apparently the government always gives public notice on all of these different programs and things that they do. But one of the quotes that I have from Alan Dulles somewhere is that the only reason why they get away with all of this stuff is that because the public doesn't read.
Yeah, well, that's the bottom line. An apathetic population is easier to control, no doubt about that.
Well, not only that, and then they dumb the population down through the compulsory education system and everything else.
I think the chemtrails are just particularly irritating me these days because it's a perfectly sunny day, and you look up in the sky, and there's that stupid anarchy sign again.
No kidding, and it ruins the day. You have, right. You end up with this mucky day and a headache, and the sky looks like hell. And, you know, people tell me all the time that I'm crazy for talking about it. I'll walk outside, and I'll be filming it, photographing it. I'll say, do you ever just walk outside and look up? I mean, and you can see the airplanes going back and forth. It's not, right. I've never seen an airliner do it. It's always been unmarked planes. I see them going back and forth. I've even called the sheriff's department here in San Bernardino when they were spraying a couple of years, and they sent out two squad cars to go film it.
And then nothing happened, of course.
Well, nothing happened, you know, but what was interesting is when I was talking to the woman on the phone, she's like, really? And I said, you know, this may sound like some crazy conspiracy theory, but you guys need to go outside and just look up and see this stuff. They're spraying the sky right now. And so after she's like, wow, really? And she's like, okay, I'm going to send some cars out to go film this. And then, interestingly, halfway through the conversation, it's like she types something in, and all of a sudden she has a list of questions, of medical questions there, that she automatically starts asking me. Do you have a headache? Are you experiencing any physical symptoms? Da, 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 da. You know, a whole laundry list of questions that she was asking me, like, on cue. You know, she pulls up, you know, chemtrails, and here's a medical right. list of questions that she's supposed to ask the caller or something, right? It was very interesting. Mm. But I'm fully with you, and I've interviewed Michael Murphy on the whole chemtrail thing. And like I said, just yesterday we were talking about this in the public notices that the government ran in every county newspaper. So, you know, it's undoubtable when you can pull up your own county's newspaper and see the public notices right there, and it even mentions the company that they're hiring to do it and the whole thing.
Totally. Well, that'd be interesting to research that company, too.
Indeed it would. So, well, we're about an hour and 15 minutes in. I think we're a long ways from getting done with all of the stuff I have here for you. We might have to, if you're open for it, to do a part two.
Definitely. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But I wanted to get into this Ames Leaf room.
Yeah, it's one of those things. Do you want me to just launch into the story?
Absolutely.
Okay, so I do talks about this sometimes. So the setup in the talk is, okay, so we got all these conspiracy theorists, and they think, you know, the pygmies are conspiring with the Martians to control the White House. And so there's some stories that, you know, are pretty out there. So here's a story that's clearly impossible. And you could go and talk to 1,000 psychiatrists, and every psychiatrist would go, this woman's obviously delusional. So this woman claims that she was a research assistant at a university, and her supervisor, who she worked for, took her into a room that was completely lined with leaves and dosed her with LSD, and she had a bad trip and had to go to the ER. So, I mean, obviously, that could never happen. On a university campus, a room lined with leaves, like, come on. So you could easily get 1,000 out of 1,000 psychiatrists to say that's guaranteed 100% delusional, that never happened. So what's the story? Well, the woman testified at the U.S., her name's Mary Ray, she testified at U.S. Senate committee hearings in the 70s. She was a research assistant at the University of Minnesota. Her boss was Amedeo Marazzi. In Amedeo Marazzi's paper, and he also worked at Edgewood Arsenal at a certain time, in Amedeo Marazzi's published paper, it says at the bottom, funded by the U.S. Office, U.S. Air Force Office of Scientific Research. And in the paper, it describes and has photographs of the Ames Leaf Room, which is called the Ames Leaf Room, because it was developed by a Dr. Ames, a psychologist, on contract to the Office of Naval Research. And what you see is, it's basically built out of plywood, 2x4s. And it's like maybe 12 by 10 by 16, 16 feet deep maybe. And it's open at one end. And there's literally leaves glued to the entire walls of the whole thing. And there's a guy sitting inside the Ames Leaf Room, who's wearing these goggles that have these lenses called anisoconic lenses, which distort everything so all the perspectives don't meet up properly, but the walls are slanting the wrong way and so on. At the far end of the room, there's a a white bar that's kind of at an angle, maybe about a 40-degree angle. And the guy sitting in there wearing these lenses is stoned on LSD, and he's adjusting two knobs to make this bar appear horizontal to him. So, in fact, her supervisor did do LSD experiments inside the Ainge Leaf room. And on top of that, I have a copy of the medical record where she goes to the ER having the bad LSD trip. So this is completely objective, actually happened, is for real, funded by the military, no doubt about it. So when you hear, so my basic point there is, first of all, it's a good story, but the basic point is there can be some really fantastic sounding claims that turn out to be totally factually true. Just because it sounds fantastic, you cannot dismiss it out of hand. And that's kind of my basic point about, I get quite a few emails and so on from people who say that they're being attacked, harassed, controlled by non-lethal weapons, electromagnetic weapons, where beams of energy are being sent at them, causing all kinds of symptoms. And so again, 1,000 out of 1,000 psychiatrists would say that's obviously delusional. This is the tinfoil hat people. But actually, there's a long history of documented public experiments with radiation, viruses, bacteria, LSD.
Not to mention radio waves that somebody might need a tinfoil hat to prevent.
Exactly. And there's U.S. News and World Report ran an article a decade ago where they're describing the weapon in terms of the specs of the weapon, the EM radiation, the frequency of the radiation, how deep it penetrates the skin, the contractor Sandia Labs, the Air Force airplane that this equipment's set in, the altitude it's at, and the beam is set towards the target. So these weapons, for a fact, exist. And since we have a long history of testing chemical, biological, and other weapons on unwitting civilians, it's not the least bit of a jump to say probably unwitting civilians have had these non-lethal weapons beamed at them. So my point is, instead of blowing it off as the tin foil hat people, who are obviously delusional, who need medication, possibly medications developed by Eli Lilly company, you have to at least consider the possibility that, you know, some people may just be delusional, but probably not 100%. And then the problem is, other than people whose thought processes are totally disorganized and obviously way off track, many of the people who contact me sound quite lucid, quite rational. They have a story. It's not fantastic other than the content. Their thought processes are perfectly reasonable. So you have to consider that some percentage of the time, which could be a large chunk of the time, this is actually going on. And then the problem, of course, is it's so totally deniable and unprovable that it's just a setup to sound like a coup.
Well, you know, and on top of that, Dr. Ross, you're Canadian, so therefore you have to have an agenda.
That's right.
I can imagine the ad hominem attacks you must get for this research. Well, I don't have to imagine because I get them myself.
Well, just on the Canadian angle, I'm actually the holder of two passports now. So, I mean, I actually voted with my feet. I actually moved from Canada to the United States and actually acquired citizenship. So can't very well be anti-American unless I'm really off the deep end. But I'm anti all kinds of things that go on in America.
That's for sure. What about Project Mockingbird or Operation Mockingbird? Do you have any information on that one?
I don't know much about that. I mean, there's
one of Frank Astell's operations and a few others there.
The one I heard the most about clinically from patients and so on is Monarch. So the problem is if these things are still classified, you can't prove they exist. And you just end up with this sort of running into a brick wall in terms of digging into them and finding out, you know, who and what.
Yeah, and it's a, you know, it's a cat and mouse game with the CIA to get anything out of them. You know, they're just constantly trying to stonewall you and you know, derail you and send you on a goose chase, and their ambiguous wording to try and fool you if they really do or really don't have anything. So we're just to the point now where anytime we get a letter back from them that denies documentation, we automatically just turn around and send it right back to them as an appeal, you know, file an appeal.
Right.
So, you know, we've gotten a little bit of documentation out of them, but pretty much everybody that we've suspected as being directly involved in MKUltra, like Dr. Richard DeMille and some others, they've flat out denied to send us the documentation. Carlos Castaneda, they've got classified. Terrence right. McKenna, they've got classified. Richard DeMille, who supposedly exposed Castaneda, they've got classified. And DeMille is another one of these guys that, like Alberelli, he sacrifices only a small part of the operation to right. hide the larger aspects. So, Professor Jay Fikes is a good friend of mine. He's the one that wrote Castaneda, Psychedelic 60s and Academic Opportunism, exposing the whole Castaneda fraud. And Professor Fikes is an initiated Huichol shaman, and he knows all of the people, you know. Mm. So the cover story is that Castaneda was working with the Yaqui Indians. It was actually the Huichol, but Professor Fikes knows all of the original people that, knows and knew those that are still alive, all the people that the Castaneda worked with, and he exposed that whole fraud. But the whole time when he was doing his investigation, he was trying to work with DeMille. He's sending his research and stuff to DeMille, and DeMille's handing it over to Peter Furst and Barbara Meyerhoff and other, you know, CIA agents that are involved in the whole operation. And then Peter Furst turns around and threatens to sue him and tell him that, you know, threatens his publishing company. So he's just now getting the book back in print after they pulled it on him. Oh, I just lost you. Are you there? I'm back. There you go. So anyway, here's Richard DeMille playing all these games and try to cover this up. But, you know, I've noticed this same pattern of how the CIA will sacrifice operatives or parts of the operation to keep the whole operation full. So if one aspect of things are getting really hot, they'll dump it. Like, you know, the early aspects of MKUltra right now that we're covering right now, it's probably because they could just dump that and still keep the whole rest exactly. of it going.
Yeah, because it's ancient history now.
Sure, you know, if you think of, the paper that you read on the Deadhead and my work on Gordon Wasson and everything, and if you think of Gordon Wasson as being this key figure that helped Huxley and these others launch the movement, then that means a whole reanalysis of the psychedelic movement needs to be yeah. done, which means that therefore there's a strong possibility that the whole damn thing was and is MKUltra and various related and some sub-project related, you know, a thing there.
Right. Yeah, that's not just a wild idea. That's a realistic possibility that deserves thorough investigation.
Sure. Well, you know, and I've been criticized for suggesting that the entire history of the foundations of the psychedelic culture be reanalyzed. You know, my last article on Wasson was Beginning a New History, you know, and I, you know, people were just outraged that I could suggest that we need a new history. Well, if the history is wrong and, you know, Wasson was CIA and not just some hapless banker, but he was actually on MKUltra subproject 58 for JP Morgan Bank, and we can show that he was an agent and show that he was working with the CFR, working with the Century Club and the CIA, then we have to reanalyze the whole history and foundations of the story. We can't just ignorantly go on and pretend that everything stays the same.
You know the Washington Mutual Bank collapse?
Yes, I do. We were just talking about that yesterday as well.
So the Washington Mutual is like too big to let it collapse. So what happens?
They sell it off for $1.5 billion.
Yeah, but there's a series of steps.
Right.
And this happens apparently fairly commonly. So the government comes in and seizes this private company on Friday. There's no legislation, there's no judges, there's no nothing. The government just comes in and seizes it.
And the heads of the Washington Mutual didn't even have time to respond because it was all done right. over the weekend and everything.
And so that's the rationale, is to prevent a run on the banks. But the sort of net part of the story is that if Washington Mutual collapsed, the FDIC was on the hook for $30 billion worth of mortgages and loans. And so the government seized Washington Mutual, which had sort of a net worth of around, it had $188 billion in deposits and a net value of around $276 billion. And over the weekend, they just erased the FDIC's liability for that $30 billion. So now we, the people, have this asset that we own that is a value of $276 billion when we're just gearing up to do an $800 billion bailout. So it'd be kind of handy to have some change to help with that. So we, the people, actually now have seized and own a $276 billion asset on Friday. And on Sunday, we sold it to J.P. Morgan for $1.8 billion. Like, what? Obviously, it's a backdoor deal.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And that's recent history. That's not ancient history. And so there's J.P. Morgan, and then they're connected to Chase Bank, which is connected to, on and on it goes.
Interestingly, J.P. Morgan Bank is one of the key banks that was doing the funding and propping up of the Soviet Union. And then here we have the vice president of propaganda. I've got all of these letters of WAS, and he seems completely ignorant of what his own boss is doing.
Which could actually be true.
Yeah, it's just mind-boggling, because here's WAS, and he's got all of these papers talking about the Soviet Union and his, Mr. Spy and whatnot. And he actually thinks that, he doesn't have any clue that his own boss and the United States have entirely propped up the whole operation and the massacre of 40 million people there, et cetera. He's just completely ignorant of that whole thing.
Which is just basic compartmentation and need to know.
Yep. Exactly. So let me ask you, what is your goal in studying mind control?
Well, first of all, it's just interesting. So it's just like intellectually interesting to me. But I don't have a grandiose goal of like reforming all of society or something. I just think that there's a whole on back to my history of psychiatry focus. I think there's a The American Psychiatric Association got Russia kicked out of the World Psychiatric Association because of political abuse of psychiatry in Russia, which was actually going on, obviously. But we've got, so we're not like the Boy Scouts of America. We psychiatry have a very unethical, harmful, bad history that's mostly in the public domain. I mean, who knows what isn't in the public domain? But just what is in the public domain, I mean, we need a truth and reconciliation for psychiatry. And then we know that there's the behavioral consultation teams at Guantanamo Bay. We know that psychiatrists and psychologists have been actively involved in intense interrogations. And the personal side of this is, as an expert on multiple personality disorder, written a whole series of books about it, I in my field have had a huge attack from False Memory Syndrome Foundation, which includes board members Louis Jolly and Weston Martin Orr. And they've been actively saying these are all bogus diagnoses. It's just made up by crazy therapists. And so this is where there's been actual attack by CIA venture and candidate program contractors. So I've personally taken a lot of guff for that. And also, it steers the profession away from acknowledging that multiple personality is a fairly common problem, and it's often highly treatable with psychotherapy, and psychiatrists need to get up to speed on it. This whole, it's just some crazy fringe thing, has been driven and perpetrated by guys who were mentoring candidate contractors. And all of that movement to discredit the multiple personality professionals came into being in the same time frame that the patients are starting to tell the multiple personality professionals about being involved in MKUltra-like programs. So that's my personal story of involvement in that, personal/professional.
Do you know anything about the Macy conferences?
Yeah, I've got Macy conferences books.
They're
part of the CIA's development of LSD.
I think the Macy conferences were a key organization behind the organization of MKUltra itself. What do you think about that?
Definitely. 100%.
Yeah. I have a large database that I use for doing all of my research, and I should share that with you and have you download it and go through it, because it's got about 6,000-7,000 data points in it, and it really paints a clear picture of how the operation is being run and who's behind it. So, whenever you get a new data point, you can just plug it in and plug in the relation, and then if you ever go back through, it's easy to, remember all of the data points in there. So I'll make sure that you get a copy of that.
Okay.
But, what we should do, if you wouldn't mind, would be to pick up a week from today, maybe at the same time, if you're available, and continue this.
I could do Tuesday, but not Thursday.
Tuesday would work fine for me as well.
Let me check here. Let's see. Maybe a couple hours later would be good. Like,
Tuesday
how about?
At 2 p.m. your time.
Yeah.
That sounds that's, perfect.
That's, wait a minute. Where are we here? Yeah, that'd be the 9th.
That's going to be noon me.
Okay.
All right. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. I didn't have anything to say.
I was just going to say, what do you think the most important idea that you would like people to take away from part one of this interview is?
Do you want me to say that, or you're going to summarize it yourself? Or
no, I want you to say what you think the most important concept that people should take away from this interview is, and then we'll do the same thing next week, but focusing on just the stuff that we covered today.
Okay. So the takeaway lesson or thought I would like people to get from this first hour and a half here is really sophisticated, highly funded mind control programs involving CIA, military, leaders of psychiatry, leading medical schools, institutionalized, actually happened for real. And it wasn't just one or two guys. And it's undoubtedly ongoing to the present. And I suspect more productized and shunted out of academia. And we just see these little hints of it in Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo Bay, what's going on in the media, public domain discussion, and so on. But I think this is a serious issue in terms of freedom, democracy, and what I don't want to see happen is our country go into a fascist, mind-controlled police state.
If it hasn't already.
Exactly.
All right, Colin. Dr. Colin Ross, thank you so much for coming on the Gnostic Media Podcast. And this is a very important topic for people to understand. And we'll have you back next week to continue our discussion.
Excellent. Thanks.